Good morning. With Ted Cruz now out of the race and John Kasich expected to leave today, Donald Trump appears to be the presumptive GOP candidate. Contributing editor Neil Milner looks at Trump's role as a populist. And today we continue our discussion of where Hawaii's education system goes from here under the ESSA. Barbara Pendicio of the Thomas Fordham Institute says Hawaii should stick with standardized testing. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. So, you're stuck on Mars. What do? You hack back on home with the NASA Space App Challenge 2016. Dev League co-founder Jason Sewell tells us about this hackathon. And when the eyes of the land are upon you, you pay attention. Namaka Okaina co-founder Joan Lander invites us to the Oivi Film Festival. It's Wednesday, May 4th. The conversation starts now. First, the news.
And to quote Lillian, we need a camera in here. If only you could have seen what was going on in this studio. Good morning and welcome to the conversation for this Wednesday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich and you, dancing fool, Bill Kozlovich. I don't know.
Well, as long as you don't know who I am, Beth Ann, my name is
Sage.
My name
I'm
is
Kozlovich,
Ted.
You're Sage.
Call me Ted or you can call me Bill, but Beth Ann, if Donald's a populist, I guess that would make me an unpopulist, but I will support whatever you say to Neil.
All right. We'll explain all of that silly business. Populism certainly is in the air in the 2016 presidential campaign. You know that. People are calling presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump a populist, and Bernie Sanders' campaign has centered on his populist appeal. It's tempting then, especially if you look at how media is covering this presidential election, to think populism is a powerful, exceptionally strong ideology right here, right now. But according to two social scientists, you'd be wrong. Contributing editor Neil Milner has some of those reasons. And we do know who you are.
Well, I have a confession to make. I'm actually Bill Sage imitating Neil Milner's voice. So, no, I'm actually Neil Milner.
I'm in trouble. I'm in such trouble.
Well, okay. So what's up?
So what's up with this is that, you know, you've been reading some of the work that two social scientists have been showing that maybe our ideas about populism and what it really is isn't necessarily what's being reflected in this thing that people are calling a movement. Is that so?
Well, it is in some very important historical ways. These two guys, Bart Bronikowski and Noam Gidron from Harvard, did this look at all of the political campaign speeches that presidential candidates made, almost all of them from 1952 to 1996. And they were looking at the evidence of populist kind of speech. Populism is basically the view that the common person's will that should be considered, what the common person wants is perverted by elites. And that's pretty much what it is. So the question is, how populist is Donald Trump? And if you look at what they say historically and in other work what they've said about Trump, there's really two different ways to look at it. One, does he talk about populism? And the answer is yes, he does. But if you look at the historical record, almost every presidential candidate who is an outsider talks about populism, talks in terms of populism. Republicans, Democrats, Eisenhower, Clinton, it's in fact populism in a political campaign is much more a political strategy than it is a serious ideology that goes forth. Once a president gets elected, even if that president talked like a populist beforehand, once he becomes an insider, he doesn't talk populism anymore. So the important thing to understand is that it's very clear that Trump talks in terms of populism. That does not necessarily mean, and there's all kinds of reasons to suspect, that even if he were elected president, mm-hmm. that's not going to bring about a populist movement.
A movement that would maybe make him look like, in fact, he had been a one-off. Because if you're talking about a long-term way of thinking and way of behaving, and that what a lot of candidates say in their populist rhetoric doesn't show up in a long-term way of being, then he's no better perhaps than any other. But is he a one-off in a lot of ways?
Well, we don't know if he's certainly a one-off compared to the past. What these researchers said about Trump is this. They say, look, when Republicans generally take populist positions, they're attacking different elites than the Democrats are. The typical Republican populism attacks bureaucrats or attacks cultural elites, you know, those academics who have these kind of sophisticated, unquote, tastes. Trump is different in the sense that he's not attacking government at all. He doesn't really attack government. He's also different in that he's more like these right-wing populist parties that are developing in Europe with some success. And that is, he's nationalistic and he's anti-immigrant. So he may be a one-off. We just can't tell. But there are reasons to suspect that even if he were elected president, it would be very hard for him. It would be very hard for him to build a movement. One, because he may not care. And I'm not there just focusing on Trump. When a person becomes president, if the populist rhetoric was basically a campaign strategy, the president has got a lot of other things on his mind, and we can say his up to now, because he's got to govern, first of all, and secondly, because why would he be interested in pushing the common person to be against elites if he's now an insider, if he's part of the elite? The second thing that makes it hard to build a movement, and this is certainly particular in Trump's case, in order to build a political movement, and if you think about the Tea Party, for example, you had a very strong grassroots organization early on, very politically involved people. That's not what the Trump voters were like. You had a political party that was very willing, well, maybe reluctant at first, but then became willing to accept Tea Party ideology and Tea Party candidates. And so that kind of movement went forward very fast with a lot of effectiveness. That's not the case with Trump. The Trump populism, if you want to call it that, is still an anathema to most of the certainly almost all the Republican bigwigs.
So what happens to his populist base? All these people who moved in his direction and who may be well disappointed if, in fact, he's elected.
He may be well disappointed, but ironically, one of the things about populism is that empirically, the populist argument is probably correct. There's been recent work over the past 5 or 10 years, and there's a recent book that we'll talk about on this show sometime that really shows that the popular will is constantly perverted, that there's very little relationship in government between what the common person wants and what actually gets developed. So there is every reason to think that there would be this kind of disappointment, considering what it's like in the past. And there's every reason to think that whoever is president has to manage that kind of disappointment. Now, I want to be real careful here. The level of anger here, the level of the exceptional case that we have here should make anybody who talks about political analysis be kind of careful and modest. So we may find something that's very different here. But to build a movement on the basis of the Trump voters, a populist movement, really requires mobilizing a group of people that have not been mobilized very much before except for a particular candidate. That's very different, say, from the Tea Party ideology. So,
and he's obviously done that well.
He's obviously done that well. That's right. It's been very candidate-oriented.
Right, but your whole point is what happens from that point on, if, in fact, he's elected, is going to look very different.
And I don't know of any Republican right now running for office who is jumping onto this Trump bandwagon with a great deal of enthusiasm. Now, remember, to use populist rhetoric is very common. It's a campaign strategy because the idea of popular sovereignty is so much a part of American culture. So you may hear a lot of it, but that may be it.
And just very briefly, though, but with all the way Trump's campaign has been running that type of populist rhetoric, it's done something different to its party than what we've seen in many past. I mean, looking at other Republicans as the enemy, that's very different.
Well, it is. Well, it's happened at various times when you've had actually progressive movements in the Republican Party with Theodore Roosevelt and for a while the La Follettes.
Yeah, but
this
not
is
in
different.
Recent times.
No, no, no. And the level of fear and loathing among Republicans here is really pretty amazing, and at least in our time, unprecedented. It's one thing to not like somebody, and it's another thing to have this kind of candidate with this kind of fear and loathing.
All right. Well, we got to leave it there for the moment. Only in the interest of time, we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, as this campaign continues. Neil Milner, thank you.
Sure.
Political analyst Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. He'll be back in a couple of weeks.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, a challenge to make NASA space apps, but first, some aeronautics in our own backyard quiz.
It's hard to believe that it has been over 100 years, 112 to be exact, since the Wright brothers made the first high-powered or flight-powered, let's try that again, first powered flight. Locally, it's pretty amazing, too, that next year Honolulu International Airport celebrates its 90th year of continuous operation. It began as John Rogers Airport back in March of 1927, and it was a lot smaller then. Even so, the first successful flight to Hawaii from the West Coast landed 3 months later. These days, scarcely anyone remembers when Honolulu International didn't have a reef runway. That was completed at a cost of $81 million in 1977 to make it safer and quieter for downtown Honolulu. Before its completion, heavily laden jumbo and military jets would come roaring over Honolulu Harbor on takeoff. Now, aside from making Honolulu safer, the reef runway had an added bonus, which was recognized and made official in 1989. Do you know what that bonus was? That's our question today. If you do know the answer, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the HPR t-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Roy Chu from Island Film Group. You're listening to The Conversation on HBR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
If you Google Space Hackathon and your name is Jason Sewell, there's a good chance that one of your students at DevLeague took part in the NASA Space Apps Challenge right here in Hawaii. DevLeague is an intense boot camp for coders co-founded by Jason Sewell. And there's also a good chance, as in 100%, that his super geeks and hyper nerds came up with 10 programs that Mr. Spock would find fascinating. Jason Sewell joins us this morning. Aloha, Jason.
Aloha. Thank you for having me.
So how did the whole thing start, this NASA app challenge?
So it actually came about as one of our students actually turned us on to it. So Laura Gonzalez, one of our current students, she had heard about it. It was, you know, building space apps was something, or kind of going into a field like that was appealing to her, so she kind of threw it out. We went and took a look at it and realized that they didn't have a current Honolulu host for what's a global event. So we applied to be the local host, and things kind of went from there, and we got accepted, and we decided to just kind of run with it and host an event here.
Now, of course, when you say hack, there's a lot of negative connotations. So hackathon, you just sort of make bad language your own and becomes positive?
Pretty much. No, so a hackathon is really, it's very much the opposite of, it's really about community and people coming together and coming up with solutions together. So it's not really kind of hacking into, you know, servers maliciously like you kind of see on TV or hear about in the news, but it's really about coming
more like
up and
shareware.
Yeah, it's problem solving. It's looking at problems that can be addressed through software or hardware or just creative thinking, and over the course of a weekend, kind of coming up with a prototype or an idea, and kind of seeing where it goes from there.
Sort of like the real time basis when Apollo 13 had a genuine problem. That was sort of a 1970s hackathon that had to happen. Where let's make this work. We have a life and death situation. So when you give a time limit, you really bring out the best in people who can do working cooperatively.
Yeah, it definitely keeps the focus, and I'm definitely kind of that nature of doing my best work when the clock is ticking, and I think a lot of people are like that. So there's kind of a competitive nature to it, and definitely some urgency that it has to get done. And so people stay up, you know, all night around the clock for an entire weekend and see what they can do.
So the NASA Space Apps Challenge itself, pretty much global in scope. Do they take, in effect, winners voted on by the hackers or the hackathoners themselves in each individual unit and then goes to a national judging panel? Or?
Yeah, so all of the global, so there was 119 locations worldwide, and each location submits two finalists that go to a global judging from NASA themselves. And so they'll, over the next month or so, they'll be evaluating all the submissions and announce a global winner.
So you could tell us about the ones which really made the grade as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, so we actually did a peer review process rather than having like a judging panel. And actually one of your NPR hosts is Bert Lum. He actually created a team called Coral Beat, and they actually got some researchers from UH and some local software developers and designers, and really over the course of a weekend put together a really nice application of kind of emphasizing the impact of coral bleaching or the phenomena and what that impact is, and put some video together, and it really put together a nice educational site around, you know, bringing awareness to it and pulled in data, you know, so you're taking some of the works that's happening at UH and some of the funding from organizations like, you know, obviously NOAA is probably funding them, but kind of that was the part of the intent of bringing the NASA hackathon here was, you know, let's get some of these research institutions that are getting money from organizations like NASA, like NOAA, get them out into the innovation community and see what kind of solutions we could come up with.
So essentially, even though it's NASA just promoting them, it's really a STEM-oriented thing which can benefit virtually everything, including spaceship Earth, which after all is in space. So yeah, the reef, yeah, that's a viable part of the space. So it covers the whole gamut. One of the other ones that intrigued me, there was the movie The Martian was just, well, it turned out not to be killer because the guy didn't die, but in effect, one of the apps that came up with was effect Surviving Mars.
Yeah, so there's they actually have challenges where you could focus on, you know, Earth-oriented solutions like the coral bleaching or you know, we're sending people to Mars and we need to simulate what life is like and what survival is like and what interaction is like. So you could actually, you know, come up with virtual reality solutions or, you know, there was actually even, you know, space gear challenges. You know, what is somebody going to wear, you know, as they go into space?
One of your people came up with a heads-up display helmet?
These were former students that came up with, you know, if you were going to go to Mars or potentially another planet where visibility may be limited, how do you know kind of what you're interacting with? Kind of the joke was, you know, when you're about to get attacked by an alien being, you know, in a low visibility situation, but They actually took some hardware, Arduino stuff, and sensors, sonar sensors, and actually built a helmet that would trigger LED lights to show how close you were to something. So.
Somehow I can see a space derelict coming coming up with a squeegee. Hey, man, for a space quarter.
Right.
This sounds like an amazing thing. It's an absolute delight. And again, time is inelastic, and we're burning through it at a rapid pace, but I'm sure you're going to do it again. Thank you so much, Jason Sewell. He's the co-founder and curriculum developer of DevLeague, a programming boot camp for teaching, coding, computer programming, and web development. He's also co-founder of Sudokru, a custom software solutions company. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information. Thanks again.
Fine print of success.
African Americans having high profile, successful careers, they are often experiencing more of these microaggressions. This is connected to depression and anxiety.
How success cannot dodge the consequences of America's racial history. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio's Spring Pledge Drive came to a successful close just a few weeks ago, and we welcome new members and say thanks to our current members and to these community partners. Nico's Pier 38, The Cab, YMCA, and Oahu Choral Society. Mahalo for your support during Challenge 2016. We really couldn't have done it without you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Lawmakers updated Hawaii's medical marijuana law yesterday, but reformers say there's still more work needed, and that could mean Hawaii nurses may soon be able to certify medical marijuana patients. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, considering the time lag between getting the dispensaries and when the law was initially passed, you know, no wonder that there had to be some updates, which we've talked about several times in many conversations. But what actually happened yesterday?
Well, Anita Hofschneider's article explains that there's some good reforms that came along in this bill that's going to the governor's desk. And I'll explain those in just a minute. But the other thing is they're almost certainly going to have to go back to tinker with the legislation, with the law next session. But here's what the new bill calls for. Yes, advanced practicing RNs will now be able to certify medical marijuana for patients. So this is in addition to doctors. So that should help a lot of folks, doctors in particular, who can be overwhelmed. Companies, those 8 companies that have the licenses for the dispensaries, they can now transport their marijuana between islands, but only for testing, only to take to a laboratory. Another thing, the dispensaries can operate on Sundays. That's good news. For some reason, the original law left that day out. There's also an exemption for patients from the state law on banning possession of drug paraphernalia. One final thing, the definition of plant itself has changed. It seems to now allow for an infinite number of seedlings and clones that are waiting to mature. So those are all good things that came out of this bill, likely to be signed by the governor, although we'll see. One never knows.
I mean, going into this session, the idea was that something was going to happen with
right.
it. The question was just how much. So if we've gotten to this point now, What still looks like it's likely for next session?
Well, I won't say it's likely for next session, but this is what reformers are calling for. Edibles are not approved under current law. In other words, baked goods, candy, smoothies with
THC. Because the idea is that not everybody should be smoking something.
Right. And I should say pills, lozenges, oils are allowed. There are skin patches and inhalers now, but there's no joints, no pre-rolled joints that can be sold, which seems sort of an odd thing given the association. As well, there's a lot of labor concerns about whether a company can fire someone if they're a medical cannabis patient, concerns about wages. And I should just point out, still, patients themselves cannot carry marijuana between the islands. So these are things that need to be worked on. I should also clarify that the bill itself establishes a working group precisely to work on some of these very issues.
Which means we'll probably be talking about those yet again. But for the moment, at least, the feeling is that at least something got done. At least there wasn't a case where, you know, there couldn't be agreement, and so nothing was going to happen for another year.
Right, and this is very typical for legislation. You often go back. One other thing I should add, greenhouses are still left out of the equation, but they are now going to allow what's known as translucent roofs, I guess roofs that are fairly clear. So no greenhouses, but at least roofs that allow the sun to shine in sunny Hawaii.
Okay, so there's a difference between having translucent roofs and translucent walls. So one of them we call a greenhouse, and we just say you can see the nice sun coming through. Okay.
I mean, another concern here is not only the amount of sunlight that we have in Hawaii, the electricity costs are enormous in this state. And so that was another concern. So I would imagine they're going to come back. The concern about greenhouses was partly security, that somehow they might be easier to break into.
And
you know, that's a big concern. One other thing, the law still does not say where these eight companies actually will get their marijuana seeds. In other words, they're not being sold legally, if you will. So they're going to probably have to go to patients themselves that are growing or other means of obtaining the crop.
I like that other means that you dropped in there. All right. Well, this for a lot of people who need this stuff, it's not a laughing matter. But as
right,
this develops,
serious.
We keep watching how it changes. And there will be more to come, no doubt. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks about that.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Good morning. It's 8:30. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Sage. If you want to be in touch, call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We're also on Twitter at HIConversation at BKOZ, BKOZHPR. Coming up, the benefits of standardized testing, and later the film festival with a decidedly Hawaiian approach. But first, the news from the BBC. Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. On Monday, we spoke with Dr. Ruth Gates about the cellular toolkit that helps free-swimming baby corals settle down and build a reef. And tonight, we'll learn about a coral nursery program. Good morning, Bert.
Hey, Bill. How's it going?
So far, so good.
Well, you know, there's a lot of interest in our coral reefs, and I happen to visit the Anui Nui Fisheries Research Center, and they've got an interesting program there where they actually are, growing corals. They, you know, I guess it's called like coral husbandry, and they are looking at different ways that they could sort of speed up the coral growing period. And I guess there's certain, under certain conditions, coral will grow faster, and I guess based on what they find, they are looking at trying to go out and repopulate some of the areas that might have been, affected by some of the coral bleaching and sort of dieback.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because if the original reefs are dying back because of changes in sea temperature, whatever's causing it, are they making or developing new resistant strains of coral that are hardier?
Well, so that's what Ruth Gates is working on, looking at different ways that she could, through experiments, assist the viability of corals in certain areas, like even in Kaneohe Bay, they have corals that are pretty resilient. So looking at trying to match those up and grow those. In the case of the folks over at the coral nursery, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about this on the show, but, they're just trying to figure out ways to grow coral and just to get the population, out there and repopulated. And they've got some interesting ways of, helping to get the coral to grow a little faster, depending on temperature and light and the nutrients.
I suppose one thing just by sheer observation, like if some of the corals in Kanehe Bay are hardier, just sort of naturally select the ones which seem to resist the temperature that causes bleaching.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And that's why I think Ruth's experiments are really kind of a key thing. Like you said, you know, she's creating a toolkit. The folks over at the Coral Nursery, I mean, they're also doing something, but they need to get stuff out there now. So, I think their attempt to do the nursery is very tactical, right? I mean, it's getting stuff out there and getting it into the damaged reefs.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an interesting show tonight, so we look forward to it.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot, Bert. That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5.
Hi, good morning. I'm Mark Kalahele from Kumukuhua Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Many of Hawaii's students have been taking a lot of standardized tests lately, making some teachers chafe at teaching time lost and others glad for what the tests measure. Senior Fellow and Vice President for External Affairs at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, Robert Pondizio, stands with the latter group. He says Hawaii is right to hold on to standardized testing. Today we continue our look at where Hawaii's education system goes from here under the Every Student Succeeds Act. And Robert Pondizio joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We've talked a lot for many years about standardized tests, and some of the big issues that teachers have are just what we talked about in the opening, that it takes a lot of time away from what would be instructional time, and that also you're really only measuring a couple of different areas, reading and math, where there's so much else that could be, and in some minds, should be measured. How do you answer them when they say we focus too much just on reading and math, and that doesn't really give you a true assessment of a child's progress?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question that would almost literally take hours to unwind. The short answer is I'm less concerned than I think if we look carefully. Most parents are even less concerned with the amount of time spent with kids in front of a test. I think the greater concern is the effects of testing on schooling. In other words, is the testing tail wagging the schooling dog, so to speak? And I think that's a legitimate concern. Where I would push back slightly is if you say that a reading test it really focuses too much attention on reading, on the one hand, I would agree with you because I think that's what's happened in our schools. But I would argue that if you really have a clear understanding of what reading is, you would know that the best way to boost reading scores is not by focusing on the skill, and I'm making air quotes, the skill of reading, but really ensuring that kids have a well-rounded education in history and science and art and music. It's a bit of a paradox, but reading is not a skill like throwing a ball or riding a bike that you can practice in the abstract. It's really, every reading test is sort of a de facto test of background knowledge and vocabulary. So if the impulse that teachers in schools have is to focus on reading as a skill or as an academic subject, so to speak, paradoxically, they may be doing more harm than good.
But a lot of teachers are saying that, you know, they feel somewhat beholden to teach what is necessary so the child can do well on the test, particularly if there's going to be some measurement of how well the teacher is doing.
No, I agree. And on the one hand, I'm not a testing opponent, but neither am I a testing or accountability hawk. I think it's a reasonable thing to suggest that in a publicly financed system, you need to have some guarantee that our education dollars are being spent wisely. And as a parent, I want to know that my child's doing well in school and whatnot. So I resist the impulse, to, as some have suggested, that which is to say we're testing too much. But I really think it's about getting our relationship with testing right. And yeah, I'm probably a little bit more open than a lot of other people in the so-called ed reform world to saying maybe it's time to think about uncoupling testing results from teacher evaluation. In other words, I want to see what any good accountability system, I would argue, should incentivize the behaviors that we want. And I think what we want is for kids, especially elementary school kids, to get a rich, well-rounded education. Common Core, in theory, is supposed to do that. That's one of the reasons that I'm a supporter of it. However, your point is a good one, that's not necessarily how it's manifesting itself in our classrooms.
When you talk about getting the relationship right, and you began to speak a bit about that just now, what else has to happen besides just uncoupling teachers from the testing?
Yeah, well, I alluded to it earlier. I've written a lot, as others have as well, about the nature of reading comprehension. So it sounds counterintuitive. If you say, you know, job one is to raise reading achievement, everybody would want that. The problem is that the elementary education, secondary education, has broadly misinterpreted that as spend more time on reading, which, as I alluded to before, tends to make things worse, not better. The way to improve reading is by ensuring that kids have a rich, well-rounded education and not cut and take time away from things like science and art and music and whatnot. Reading is really a reflection of your broad general education. I think that's how we got into the business of testing it. But we have, in narrowing our focus to reading, we have also, alas, narrowed the curriculum to reading, and that can very easily do more harm than good.
Right. Too much of a focus on the mechanics itself and not realizing that because it moves through all of education, you're obviously reading when you're learning about science or when you're talking about social studies.
No, that's exactly right. And then a reading test, I've said for years, it's a de facto test of background knowledge. I used to teach in the South Bronx of New York City, and I would see this when my kids had reading test passages about subjects they knew about, they tended to do well. If they had a reading passage about something more academic, since we were doing exactly what I was complaining about, taking away time from history and science, so if they had a nonfiction passage about, say, New York State history, they tended not to do very well on that. It wasn't their fault. They didn't suddenly become bad readers. They were just reading out of their depth.
Question for you about this whole idea of moving through whole child development, which we've seen, you know, resurge at different mm-hmm. times over the last 20, 30 years in particular. But now it seems like we've moved back into that again under the ESSA. And your point is that, you know, that's pretty good, but you're still going to have to test to it. What's that ratio? What's the balance of really teaching to the whole child and also making sure that what you're teaching is something that's measurable under a standardized test?
Yeah, you know, I will confess that when I hear phrases like teaching the whole child, it tends to make alarm bells ring, not because I'm hard-hearted and don't think that that's important, but too often that's code for, oh, well, we're not worried about a child's academics because they have all these other things that we have to be concerned about first. So that can very, very quickly become one of those slippery slopes. I'm at the risk of oversimplifying. I'd like to see schools do well what they're supposed to do well at, which is to attend to a kid's academic performance. Again, not to be dismissive of those other things, but let's not use those as a barrier to making sure that kids are well educated. The other issue that you raise is the trickier one. I'm not a psychometrician, but I'm not sure that we really have good measurements of things like social and emotional well-being, for example. Same thing with the so-called non-cognitive skills. Everybody knows that they matter, and we know how to measure them. What we don't seem to know as much is how to improve or enhance them.
And that said, looking at how that fits within the academic setting, in fact, is that even, you know, entirely appropriate there? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about what teachers are expected to do and how
right.
much we want from our teachers, and obviously to be concerned about a child's full development, but to focus more on all of the academics, which are not just broken out into those, you know, two columns of reading and math.
Yeah. It's a tricky and sometimes sensitive conversation. I mean, it's obvious that if a child is not, well-fed and feels welcome and accepted in school, then that's a barrier to learning. On the other hand, there are some parents who will quickly say, hey, look, that's not your concern. I'm concerned with my child's well-being. Your job is to teach him, math and reading and science and whatnot.
With the way you see things developing now that we're having yet another shift under the ESSA, what do you think we really need to be looking at substantially for being able to test well, being able to see that our kids can go out there and compete well, not just among their peers within our nation, but to be able to effectively manage new jobs and be able to work in a global and very yeah. often cooperative situation.
Yeah, I'm an unabashed local control guy. I think that's the way our system works. That's the system we have. It's not going to change constitutionally. It's, you know, under the enumerated powers, education is always going to be a local issue. But that's a blessing and a curse. And what I mean by that is it places the onus on Hawaii and 49 other states and other territories to be really, really good at this. And the larger problem that we have, and it's kind of hard to say this without sounding like I'm bashing teachers and schools, and I'm not. You know, we have, generally speaking, a capacity issue in American K-12 education. One of the effects, I think, of the move to raise standards, it will be that it will reveal a lot of about our school systems. For historically, at least since the No Child Left Behind era, state tests have tended to set a very low bar for proficiency, and this can create kind of a proficiency illusion where you get a good report back on state tests about how your child is doing, and it's not until they get into college or the workplace that you find out that they really didn't have all their needs met in K-12. So whether you support or do not support Common Core and the associated tests, the one thing that I think is unambiguously good about them is it sets a much more rigorous and, I would argue, real-world definition of what proficiency means. On the one hand, that leads to some harsh medicine, so to speak, or some unpleasant news when you find out that the child that you thought was doing well is not doing as well as you'd hoped. But on the other hand, if we don't start from that baseline of clear-eyed data, then it's very hard to improve from there.
And you're really arguing a case for having a very realistic view of what's happening and truly understanding how well that is being reflected in, for example, how the U.S. is ranked globally in terms of its education system and
yes.
where we have fallen over many, many years. Thank you so much for joining us. I do wish we had more time to talk.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Robert Pondicio is Senior Fellow and Vice President for External Affairs at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. He's also a senior advisor to Democracy Prep Public Schools, a network of high-performing charter schools based in Harlem, New York. He writes and speaks extensively on education and education reform issues.
Aloha, I'm Kent from the Japanese American Citizens League. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Since we've been discussing the NASA Apps Challenge today, it seems fitting that we've asked an aeronautical question for the backyard quiz. After all, the first A in NASA stands for aeronautics. So, we told you that Honolulu International Airport's reef runway, completed in 1977, was designed to increase safety and reduce aircraft noise for downtown Honolulu. Before it was built, heavily laden military and commercial jets, especially jumbos taking off from Runway 8, would roar right over the harbor or downtown, and many feared it was a disaster waiting to happen. Luckily, the reef runway opened before any such misfortune occurred, but we told you the 12,000-foot-long reef runway had another safety bonus, and it involved NASA. In 1989, they designated the reef runway as an official emergency landing site for the space shuttle program. And that, too, never had to be used. Safety first.
And Tim Roy called us from Kaka'ako, knew the answer. Actually, this was a very popular quiz. We had the phone bank lighting up on this one. So sorry to everybody else who didn't get in there first, but Tim Roy did. He gets the T-shirt. And thanks so much for playing the backyard quiz. It's now 8:48, and if you've got a backyard quiz for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This year marks the 5th anniversary of the OEV Film Festival, which is dedicated to giving Native Hawaiian people voice and vision through films documenting traditional and contemporary Hawaiian culture. politics, history, language, and the environment. But this year is bittersweet for documentary filmmaker Joan Lander. She and her partner Puhipau founded Nga Makaukaina, The Eyes of the Land, in 1982, and Puhipau left us just a few months ago. This year, the festival is dedicated to his memory. Joan, aloha.
Aloha.
So I know it's tough to talk about, but it must be spoken of, so if you could tell us something about Puhipau.
Well, this weekend's film screenings are being held as a tribute to Puhipau, who's been my husband and partner and co-producer for 35 years. We've been making documentary and educational programs together. We met back in 1981 after the Sand Island evictions. Puhipau had been involved as a spokesperson for the group of residents who had settled down on Sand Island, and he ended up getting arrested during the eviction.
I remember those.
And there was a documentary made about that called The Sand Island Story, produced by Victoria Keith and Jeremy Rochford of Windward Video. And they, I was involved as an editor on that documentary and met Puhipau when he came into our post-production studios to do the voiceover narration. So we got together because he saw the power of media when that program went on PBS stations around the United States in 1982. And he wanted to start using video as a means to tell his story and the history of Hawaii. And I had been involved with video production since the mid-70s with a group called Video Lolo, and shooting educational programming and training people to use the small format video equipment to make programs for the new public access channels, which were just starting out in those days.
Uh-huh.
And but I wanted to produce documentaries about Hawaii, and Puhipau wanted me to help him, so it was a perfect fit, and we went on to produce about 90 programs on Hawaiian culture, history, land rights, the environment, Hawaiian language, music and dance. And now we distribute those programs on DVD through our website.
And this weekend, it's the Saturday and Sunday at the Honolulu Museum of Art, correct?
Yes.
So what are some of the featured films this week?
Well, you know, Puhipau always said that in order to bring about change, you have to know your history. So.
Right.
Back in 1993, we produced a program called Act of War, The Overthrow of the Hawaiian Nation, and that aired on PBS stations around the United States. And then the year after that, that same year we also released The Tribunal, which will show on Saturday night at 7. And this covers the proceedings of the People's International Tribunal Hawaii, which was convened by Dr. Kekuni Blaisdell in 1993. Now, Kekuni passed away within days of Puhipau passing away, so this screening is also a tribute to Kekuni and his efforts to bring awareness of the independence issue to a worldwide audience.
And that film I remember when they had Iolani Pelas draped in black and the American flag was not flying. That was really powerful.
Yes.
So you also have another film coming up which will be featured, and I believe that's the Mauna Kea Temple Under Siege.
Yeah, we produced a Temple Under Siege in 2006, and it's so ironic that we took 6 years shooting that program, and the reason being that we wanted to capture the mountain in all the different seasons of the year, you know, both from sea level and
uh-huh.
from the summit. So we would wake up at 3 a.m. in our home in Kau and drive to the summit in time for the sunrise to catch that red-tinted snow phenomenon that happens up there. And we were trudging around up in the low oxygen level at 14,000 feet with our 20 pounds of equipment to get these shots. And the documentary aired on PBS Hawaii and also PBS stations across the United States. But what's so amazing is that the recent demonstrations of last year, everyone had cell phone cameras and small handheld cameras, all of which were much better quality than anything we used to have in the past. And they were able to instantly upload footage to the internet, you know, if not to mention live streaming. So the whole world had access to the events that were occurring on the mountain in real time.
Right.
And as a result, you know, the social change happened much more rapidly. So it was very gratifying to us to see how access to the media has changed when we first started.
So you can continue actually being part of the scene and incorporate what is happening from people all over contributing for future documentaries, I bet.
Yeah. It made me realize, well, I mean, there's something to be said for the one-hour documentary that shows on public television and stuff, but it almost seems that these short, user-friendly videos that people are uploading about issues are much more, they get to a lot more people, you know, people don't, who don't have time to watch a one-hour program. But we still feel that our one-hour program helped to lay the groundwork for the background of them.
So you do feel that your documentaries do make a major difference, and they've laid the groundwork to continue making a difference.
I think so, yeah.
There are a couple of more films being featured. One of them is Pele's Appeal.
Yeah, we produced that back in the late 80s. It's a program about the, it focuses on the efforts to stop the desecration of the goddess Pele by geothermal drilling in Puna on Hawaii Island. And it kind of just brings up the fact that Pele is considered a living deity, you know, her eruption, her heat, her lava and steam, and her family includes the forest plants and the animals and other natural forces. So that issue is still alive today, you know, and it just delves into the issue of what sacred means in today's world.
Sacred means a lot of things. I wish we had more time to go on, but unfortunately constraints of time prevent me from doing it. But the Honolulu Museum of Art this weekend features the 5th annual OEV Film Festival dedicated to Puhipau. Thank you so much for being with us today, Joan.
Mahalo.
Joan Lander is a documentary filmmaker with Ngā Makaukaena, who document traditional and contemporary Hawaiian culture, politics, history, language, the environment, and is committed to recognizing Hawaiian independence and sovereignty. This year, of course, the festival dedicated to Puhipau. Learn more about the festival on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Well, I wake up listening to Morning Edition every day. And if I'm lucky, I get to listen to more than, you know, 45 minutes before I have to head out to work. But sometimes I have really long drives in the morning up to the North Shore, and it's nice to kind of be comforted by today's news and some familiar voices.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
The family kitchen table will soon be an interactive device.
It's a touchscreen display. Up to 5 people can use it at a time. You can research recipes from there. You can check your email. In the morning, you can have your coffee and you can read the news.
The Kitchen of the Future. I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason. Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
You were just talking with Joan Lander about the OEV Film Festival coming up this weekend. And the way she was talking about how everyone now can, you know, whip out his or her phone, we've talked about that for a long time, but the thing that I found interesting is she doesn't look at that as being a threat. She really seemed to be happy that people have the ability to do that. And whereas you may get, you know, a lot of things out there that aren't necessarily true and factual, it's been a helpful thing to be able to document.
Well, standing on the shoulders of giants is a good analogy because they're, quote, clunky equipment, but still, the people with the skill and experience at editing, when they have the contributions of everybody, what they could put together as masters of guiding the visual arts is something that really makes an impact and will continue to, in my mind.
Which means to say everybody needs an editor.
That's right.
Well, a lot of good editing has gone into some of those films, obviously crafting a certain message, but that's the whole job of it. And that's really where we've had a lot of conversation about the loss of what it means to have a good editor.
Exactly.
That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. We're going to be back tomorrow. I'm going to talk to Joe Wilson, half of the duo behind the Kumuhina Project, to look at what the DOE's policy on transgendered students ought to be.
Plus, we'll sit down with Reem Bazus, a local artist and UH professor who uses fireworks in her art. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
All of our shows are archived on the HPR archive, which you can find if you look under the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Sleepy Bill Sage.
Evidently. And I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, still here with you. We will join you tomorrow morning.
I'm Ted Cruz. I'm
more
not here.
Of the conversation.